Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, January 21st, 2020, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to the Federal Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon's topic is titled Amazon's Case Against President Trump. Did DOD unfairly give Microsoft the right to be the Jedi Master? My name is Wesley Hodges, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are very fortunate to have with us a great panel to discuss this topic, and our moderator is Dan Kelly, who is a partner in the Government Contracts and Export Controls Practice Group at McCarter & English. After our speakers have their remarks, we will have time for your questions, so please keep in mind what you'd like to ask for the later parts of the call. Thank you very much for sharing with us today. Dan, the floor is yours.
Thanks so much, Wesley, and we're happy to be here. Pleased to introduce two of my partners, Alex Major and Franklin Turner, who lead our Government Contracts and Global Trade practice at McCarter & English. It's fair to say that Alex and Franklin have a great deal of experience in bid protests, which is what this matter is about. And I'm very anxious to hear their comments and concerns with regard to the award to Microsoft and the protest by Amazon. So we're the Government Contracts guys. We have had the pleasure of doing one of these teleforums before. We talked about DOD's encroaching arm and with regard to cybersecurity mandates on its government contractors and the entire DOD supply chain. That continues and remains an ever interesting topic, and I'd ask you to check our website at McCarter.com on recent events concerning cybersecurity. But here today we're talking about one of the largest contracts that DOD has ever issued, and that is a $10 billion, 10-year contract called the Joint Enterprise Defense Infrastructure Contract, JEDI. I'm sure we may have some Star Wars jokes during the course of this hour. The contract was issued to Microsoft by means of an announcement that took place on October 25th. I think the award was made about 10 days before that. I thought we could start maybe by talking about the nature of the contract itself, what DOD, the Department of Defense, is seeking, and then the rules governing DOD and going out and procuring these services. So, Alex, do you want to take a shot at describing the initiative that DOD began back in September to upgrade its cloud computing?
All told, what DOD is trying to do is they're trying to bring into house or under one roof all of cloud computing. As everybody probably knows, or as a lot of people know, especially in the government contract space, what's been going on since around 2010, 2012, the whole concept of cloud first, where the government has really been pushing for more and more express and explicit use of cloud services. This has been probably a long time coming. It's been a long time being fought. The concept here is to try to bring in a service under one program, under one mechanism, cloud services for the entire Department of Defense. In the spectrum of, like, as you were saying, one of the largest programs contemplated by DOD to date.
And that would house not only unclassified information, but secret and top secret information. And as I understand it, they're asking for enhanced and advanced data analytic capabilities like machine learning and artificial intelligence. It's a really complex contract. Is that fair to say?
Extremely. And what's interesting about anything like that, anytime you're dealing with any sort of IT infrastructure, I mean, that's what you're talking about, especially for something, you're looking at the IT backbone of the Department of Defense. They need to make sure that whatever they receive is not only effective with today's technology, but receptive of what's coming down the road and down the pike. So right now, that's something that the DOD has often struggled with in terms of making sure that they had one, I'm going to say, unified infrastructure architecture that they can plug and play. It's been something that the services have been battling from my time back in the military all the way to today. So they're still working on trying to integrate not only the new stuff, but also the old stuff, so that everybody across all services are happy. And as anybody that deals with the Department of Defense knows, that is a very, very wide swath of people and interests.
Even though this is a big whopper of a contract, DOD is still bound by the same statutes and regulations which govern the procurement of goods and services for anything it might attempt to procure. So I thought it might make sense for the listeners for us to talk about what the rules are, because it's a violation of those rules that Amazon is now asserting in its challenge to this award to Microsoft. So, Franklin, you want to give us a little bit of background on the Competition and Contracting Act, and in particular, the form of procurement or solicitation that was used in this case?
So the Competition and Contracting Act is known, I think, affectionately as CECA for the folks who work with it every day. And the purpose of it is to ensure free and open competition. And ultimately, the goal that the Department of Defense wants, or any procuring executive agency, is to receive the best value from the competitors, right? Now, there are exceptions to free and open competition. There's sole source contracting, which is not the subject of today and which I won't really get into. But this was a competition that was open to qualified offerors, to qualified companies. It was governed by the requirements of the Federal Acquisition Regulation, which are at Part 15. And the goal here, as I said, is for the government to get the best value. Now, what does best value actually mean? That's a question that I think is asked just about every time the government issues a source selection under FAR Part 15. The purpose of a best value procurement is for the government to get the right mix, in the government's view, of whatever the actual requirement is of the expertise from the offerors to serve the most effective solution for the government, right? To provide the most effective solution. And there is no absolute answer as to what constitutes the best value, right? It's a subjective assessment. It's a trade-off. When the government looks at an offeror's proposal, they evaluate it against the criteria set forth in the solicitation, which here there were 9 separate evaluation factors, I believe, and they decide which proposal, for lack of a better term, really hits the mark with respect to each of the factors, right? And the factors vary widely from solicitation to solicitation. In this one, as I said, there were 9, including the price, and then all sorts of other things, everything from the technical aspect to the logical isolation and secure data transfer capabilities, to tactical edge, to small business participation approach, et cetera, right?
Let's break that down a little bit. So when Alex mentions Part 15, he's talking about Part 15 of the Federal Acquisition Regulation, which is codified at Title 48 of the Code of Federal Regulations. The government doesn't necessarily have to use Part 15. It can, as Franklin mentioned, issue a sole source procurement. It can use Part 14, which is called sealed bidding, where price is the only determinative factor as long as the offerors or the bidders are responsible contractors. But in this case, they've chosen Part 15. So under Part 15, does the lowest price win?
No, not all the time, right? There's a lot of law out there, and we'll talk about the various fora later where you actually see this law come out, right? It comes out primarily at 2-4, right? It's either going to be at the GAO, right, which is the Government Accountability Office, or the Court of Federal Claims. Those are the primary for law that kind of interprets the extent to which the government conducted a best value acquisition in the quote-unquote right way. It does not have to be the lowest price at all, then. It can be a higher priced, higher technically rated offeror. That's entirely consistent with a procurement under FAR Part 15.
Right. In the solicitation or the RFP, the request for proposals, in this particular procurement that was issued back in July of 2018, the solicitation in sections L and M, those are the sections which deal with how the government is going to actually procure the services and goods that are identified in the scope of work in the solicitation, there was a definitive statement that technical factors would be more important than price. I mean, one thing that bid protest lawyers focus on, and what the lawyers representing Amazon have focused on in their 103-page complaint they filed with the Court of Federal Claims, is focused on the particular way in which the government said that it was going to evaluate each of the offers and whether, in fact, they abided by the rules that they set out in the solicitation itself. That's always a driving force when it comes to lawyers examining whether there is a protestable offense and the roadmap for preparing a brief and challenging a procurement. But I want to dig a little bit deeper in terms of how this thing unfolded, which is the use of a competitive range determination, which is available under Part 15 of the FAR. Alex or Franklin, you want to take a whack at explaining what a competitive range determination means?
Essentially, when the government conducts a competitive range decision, what they're doing is they're narrowing the field of capable offerors that appear to basically meet kind of the core requirements of the solicitation. And it's used for a variety of different reasons, but the primary reason is so the government can effectively work with the offerors that and evaluate the offerors as they move through the process that, in the government's view, have a legitimate shot at actually providing what it is the government wants, right? And in this specific procurement, there were essentially two phases. You had phase one, where the Department of Defense conducted an evaluation of each offeror pursuant to factor one in this RFP, which is the gate evaluation criteria. And the purpose of that criteria was basically to ensure that the JEDI cloud that is being proposed by each offeror was capable of providing all of the services that the Department of Defense wanted that were set forth basically in the performance work statement, which is an attachment to this massive solicitation and which would ultimately be referenced in the JEDI contract. The other, you know, primary purpose is to ensure that the offerors actually understand the requirements. It's easy, right, in the DoD space, actually in the government space writ large, for companies to submit, you know, kind of broad capability statements or proposals that say, you know, we're going to comply with everything, we understand what we're doing here, et cetera. It's quite another thing for those proposals to actually reflect a granular technical understanding of what it is the government wants. This work is so highly specialized, it's so highly unique, that a competitive range determination here was, I think, and I think most folks in the industry would say, right, was something that the government needed to do, made sense for them to do it, and that's exactly what they did. And they conducted the determination, I believe, in
April 2019.
And the pool of competitors there was effectively narrowed to just Microsoft and Amazon.
So
sorry, Alex.
The litigants that are in this bid protest case, and I say litigants because the suit is against the United States of America, but Microsoft, as the awardee, is permitted to intervene and will obviously participate in the protest itself.
Back in April, when this competitive range was identified, that actually spawned additional litigation by those people, those companies that weren't chosen and selected. One of those primarily was Oracle. So, and that continues to this day. So that's still proceeding. Whenever you have those sort of competitive range determinations, you also possibly key into other litigants. So yes, right now we're talking about the actual award, but I think it's important to recognize that other people are still fighting this fight, specifically Oracle, where they asked at some point, or basically have asked the courts to eliminate Amazon from the procurement as well.
Yeah, that's a great point. And it's also a point about the nature of sort of the bleak house-like conditions that can occur in bid protest world, where decisions can be made to go back to the drawing board. Those decisions can be challenged, and you can have a initial bid protest morph into litigation that may go on for years, and the result delayed for years.
I can't believe, Dan, you just made a Dickens reference when we're talking about...
I did. I wanted to make a Lucas reference, but I made a Dickens reference. So here we've got an award announced on the 25th. A little bit more on procedure and how an award works. One interesting take in all this, which was of some excitement, I think, to folks like us who do this for a living, is that DoD, as a result of, I think it's the 2018 National Defense Authorization Act, enhanced the rights of disappointed bidders following their notice of an award to someone else. And one of those enhancements was the put more teeth in what's called the debriefing practice or right that exists under Part 15. One of you guys want to talk about what a debriefing is and how it was enhanced and how Amazon tried to take advantage of that?
A debriefing is essentially when you get to go to the government, whether it be any agency it might be, and request a kind of a very brief rundown of exactly maybe why you were or weren't chosen. And so it allows the contractor, and again, you can receive a debriefing as a recipient of an award, but it allows the competitor and competitors to see how they were assessed, see how well they did. So it's a report card, if you will, in many areas. Enhanced debriefing was an effort by the government to try to figure out a way to eliminate protests. Franklin and I have dealt with this on a number of occasions, and I know you have as well, Dan. In my opinion, Franklin, I think we might have a differing opinion in here. The enhanced debriefing, enhanced post-award debriefing rights, I think have a better sound to it than they actually do in terms of effect. Franklin, would you agree with that?
I mean, one of them is the ability within 2 days of the debriefing itself to ask questions, right? And the government is forced to respond to those questions within a certain amount of time, the awarding agency, and the ability to file a protest is delayed until those questions have a response. Is that right?
Yes. Right. That's a very good summary there, Dan. The purpose of an enhanced set of debriefing regulations is to ward off filing the protest under the theory that if the offeror receives kind of more granular information about why it wasn't selected, then it's not going to go through the protest process, right? Because it'll be satisfied that the government actually conducted the evaluation in a correct way. I think Alex is absolutely right in terms of the enhanced set of regs essentially not providing much relief because it still tells a very one-sided story. When you file a protest, and I think this is a good opportunity to sort of explain the traditional protest process, and I think we can start essentially from the award date here. If you think about what happened on October, I think it was the 25th, right, there was the announcement that Amazon was the unsuccessful offeror. At that point in time, the company had a variety of choices in terms of how it was going to move through the protest process, if it wanted to move through the protest process at all, right? In this case, the first thing you should do under FAR Part 15, if you have a negotiated acquisition, which is exactly what FAR Part 15 is to ask for the debriefing. This debriefing was not conducted in person. I think it was delivered. And you tell me if I'm wrong here, Alex, I think it was the same day that they received the award notice, right? Didn't they also get the debriefing?
Yeah, Amazon received a written debriefing notice the same day.
Right. Then they submitted, I believe, some like 265, I think is the right number, separate questions relating to essentially how they were evaluated in the way that they were, why they were evaluated that way. They sent in those questions, and then they were unsatisfied with the answers that came back from the government. The experience, as Alex said, you know, we do this an awful lot and have a lot of experience in the space. Most folks on the government side are not going to give competitors an awful lot of information in terms of why they lost. They'll go through basically why their proposal was evaluated in the way that it was. They're supposed to answer kind of reasonable questions set forth by the offeror who was unsuccessful. Oftentimes what the government does, though, is provide non-answers, right? And they say, well, thank you for your question. We can't tell you that information. They can't give any information, even under the enhanced set of regs for this procurement. They couldn't give granular information about Microsoft's solution, right? They couldn't explain, you know, from a functional standpoint, why it was that Microsoft won in terms of granularity, like what exactly about their proposal was superior in the eyes of the Department of Defense.
We know that the agency had a scorecard, right? And we know that the agency identified specific evaluation factors and sub-factors that it was going to look at and use that scorecard to grade both Amazon and Microsoft on their performance in each of these factors for purposes of making the best value determination. But the frustrating thing, I assume, for Amazon and for many of our clients who find themselves in this space as the disappointed bidder, is that you're not entitled to see any of the information with regard to how the awardee in this case was graded. Do I have that right?
That's exactly
yeah.
Right. And it's why you file a protest if you really want to get in to figure out what it is the agency did. And there's three typical protests for here, right? There's the agency, and then there's the GAO, and then there's the Court of Federal Claims.
What is the GAO?
The GAO is the Government Accountability Office. It is the watchdog agency of the federal government. they actually have a special procurement law unit that is staffed by lawyers, by specialists who are sort of de facto administrative law judges who are vested with the responsibility to adjudicate these protests. Most companies, by and large, will file a protest at the GAO because you get, if you file within the right time frames, you can get an automatic stay of performance, meaning that the contract award is effectively halted. You can get a resolution in 100 days, which is prescribed by statute and which is lightning speed in the world of government contracting. You know, those of you who interact with the federal government from a litigation standpoint, or really any other standpoint, I think would likely agree that the government can sometimes move at a glacial pace. That is not the case at the GAO. What effectively would happen at the GAO is you file the outside counsel that you retain, which is strongly advisable here because anytime you ever file a protest, if you want to win, you should work with someone who really understands these regulations because it's very highly regulated. The decisions often turn on nuances of bid protest law, and to really understand kind of what it is that you're going to do, you should treat this basically like a full legal brief.
Yeah, one of the things too that's kind of unique about bid protests for those that don't practice in the area. And this is often very, very challenging for clients, especially new to the government contract space, to recognize, is that because of that very thing that we were talking about, or you were talking about it earlier, Dan, the integrity of the competitor's data needs to be retained. So that means that if there is going to be a bid protest, the government is not, because they can't answer those questions, one of the reasons they can't answer a lot of the questions that, you know, our disappointed bidders want is because they need to make sure that they do not provide proprietary information to competitors. So in this same respect, when you have a bid protest, what you're actually doing is you're literally putting the defense and prosecution of your case into your lawyer, your representative's hands, and then you, the company, the disappointed bidder, need to step away from it, have to step away from it, because as your advocate, we can look at the other side's materials and we can see how the government chose and didn't choose or elected to avoid certain requirements, but we can't show that back to our client because we're seeing the competitor's information. So one of the things that Franklin's describing here is often really, really hard for a lot of maybe commercial companies that are dabbling in the federal procurement space, or maybe companies that aren't, or small businesses that aren't necessarily familiar with this process, because you are literally blind. All you know is what limited information, or whatever, like we saw with JEDI complaint, redacted information that is able to be released to you. So that's always really challenging for our clients.
And it's very difficult in cases like this where the determinations can be highly technical. I just add sort of as a footnote that the lawyers can retain an outside expert to assist them and get access to that information, but yet it can't be a person who is connected with the company. So the company places in the hands of the lawyers the ability to go forward and do this protest, but the lawyers are really muzzled when it comes to talking about the particular aspects of the way in which it was evaluated, the source selection material, and also the information contained in the proposal and other submissions by the competitor that won the award. I'd say one more thing about GAO, which is why a reason why most people go to GAO in addition to getting a decision in 100 days, is that by filing within a certain limited period of time following award, the Competition and Contracting Act affords a bidder what's called an automatic stay. The agency cannot proceed with the contract until the bid protest is decided. Now, there are some exceptions to this, but here I think we can end our discussion with GAO because the lawyers for Amazon decided not to go to GAO. They decided to go to the Court of Federal Claims. Perhaps you guys can talk about that avenue for relief and how this is unfolded procedurally on FAR, and then we can get to the merits of the actual case.
Absolutely. So the Court of Federal Claims is obviously a very, very different forum. You have a different timeline. You're talking about a real court at this point.
Many Federal Society members have been appointed to the Court of Federal Claims, so I'm glad you call it a real court.
Well, I'm just saying, as opposed to working with the GAO and the administrative positions there. So at the Court of Federal Claim, bid protests take on a little bit different tenor, a little bit different texture.
Can you just sue in district court? Can you sue in a federal district court, or is this the only court available if you want to go to court as opposed to GAO?
It's going to depend. If you're looking at the procurement side of things, yes, you're gonna need to stay at the Court of Federal Claims, and then you can appeal through the Federal Circuit. We have seen, you know, on rare instances of district courts coming into play, but it's generally not against the United States government. Generally, it's going to be some tangential element related to a contract and not necessarily specific to the procurement choices.
Right, and there are jurisdictional limitations. I mean, the government has immunity, and you can only sue the government when it decides to waive that immunity. And by statute, it has waived the immunity with respect to bid protests to only these specific fora that we've been talking about.
Right. So with the GAO, it is going to be, we've seen it normally with larger matters like the Jedi case, or if there is a situation on the GAO side of things, if it's
you mean the Court of Federal Claims?
No. On the GAO side of things, for just a moment.
Got it.
You indicated about the stay.
Right.
Oftentimes, an entity might either miss that deadline, or they might not have acted in a manner that was quick enough to necessarily protest in front of the GAO. In those situations, and there are a lot of decision points to be made here in terms of timing, in terms of requirements, in terms of wants, in terms of needs, in terms of the appetite of the adjudicators. But as a result of many of those factors, often which are business decisions or business indecisions in some respects, the choice can be going to the Court of Federal Claims. The reason being is you have more time to bring your protest. Now, there are difficulties in delaying a protest decision decision to protest, namely if the government has started acting on the contract or is proceeding against award of that contract. You run into situations where the government is probably going to, or the court is going to be less likely to award the protest, right? They're going to, or to affirm the protest because the government is already proceeding. The government is already going forward with its process. There's also some unique differences specific to the GAO. There are no specific statute limitations for the filing of the bid protest at the COFC. So you do have some time. We don't recommend delaying too much. Otherwise, you have a contract in action that's going to be hard to turn around. Also, unlike the automatic stay at the GAO, the CEQA automatic stay has no application to the Court of Federal Claims bid protest, right? So in order to stop performance in front of the Court of Federal Claims, you need to literally file provisional injunctive relief, so a temporary restraining order, a preliminary injunction, that sort of stuff. So we're talking more in the line of what I think most lawyers would recognize as like in a civil hearing and recognizing that. Now, the court has its own rules, right? So you need to make sure that you're following the rules just like any local rule of the federal court. And then you're going to be getting into the actual process. And we can talk about that a little bit. But the actual, when push comes to shove, the actual process of a protest before the Court of Federal Claims is going to be a little bit different than maybe the back and forth people normally recognize in front of a U.S. district court. So you're generally going to have the protester that files a complaint. The government will obviously respond, and the intervener. And I don't know if we've talked about the intervener, but when we're talking about the intervener in this capacity, what we're talking about is the awardee. So in terms of what we're talking about in terms of JEDI, obviously the protester is Amazon, the government is the Department of Justice acting on behalf of the Department of Defense, and the intervener would be Microsoft. They'll respond generally maybe with a kind of a loose answer, basically saying you're wrong, and then they'll move. So they'll move for judgment on the administrative record. The protester then would reply and respond to the cross motion as well. And then you'll see the government and the intervener also reply. So what this tries to do is this tries to kind of cut to the quick, recognizing that any federal contract action, any sense of federal contract effort obviously has this air about it of requirements or needs or kind of some urgency. So what this process tries to do by not doing what I would consider the traditional district court back and forth and going into discovery and all this other stuff, while it's still available, there are processes in place within the Court of Federal Claims that allows the process to move forward much, much faster, not as fast as the GAO, but much faster than one would see in a normal district court.
And just one side question. I know at GAO, when you file a protest, oftentimes lawyers will get involved from the agency itself for purposes of assisting the contracting officer in rebutting the allegations. And those are in-house lawyers within the particular agency. But when you file at the Court of Federal Claims, who are the lawyers that represent the United States of America in that case?
That's going to be the Department of Justice. They have their own civilian FCA, or FCA, their own civilian non-criminal attorneys.
So it's a completely different group. Of course, they're well-schooled and I've done protests before, but you get a different group of lawyers when you file at the Court of Federal Claims. So let's talk about this case. The case has made headlines throughout the world because it is framed around, first of all, the complaint was filed in early December, December 9th. It did not seek a temporary restraining order or preliminary injunctive relief at the time. There was a footnote which said that the first page of the complaint, which is publicly available, it's redacted, it's heavily redacted, but there's a lot of meat still that's available for the public to look at. The complaint said that they were not seeking a TRO because the DOD had agreed not to proceed with performance of the contract until at least February 11th. The government's brief is due today, but we've learned, which we can talk about in a minute, that Amazon has actually announced that it is filing, I believe, on January 24th, that's in a few days from now, a motion for a preliminary injunction or a TRO, which we expected. But the complaint made world headlines because it is framed around a theory of bias on the part of the President of the United States and his ongoing feud with Jeff Bezos, the owner of Amazon. And if you turn to, you look at the complaint, you'll see a catalog of statements, some of which are quite colorful, that President Trump has made in connection with Amazon. And they juxtapose that with various comments that were made in the industrial press about how Amazon was by far the most qualified company to actually perform this work, that in fact they were the only qualified company to perform this work. These weren't statements made by government officials, but they describe it as a general consensus within the industry as a whole. And I'll just tick off a few of these statements that they attribute to Trump, which they say improperly influences procurement. They go back to Trump as a candidate in February of 2016, saying that Amazon will have problems if he becomes president, that they're getting away with murder, that they're rigging the system, that Mr. Bezos is a tool for political power against him, and he won't be able to get away with it. And then they quote an article in Vanity Fair where sources said that President Trump became obsessed with Mr. Bezos after he was elected and was determined to fudge him. That's not the word that he used, but that's right there in the complaint. And since the procurement was announced, the complaint alleges that the president has spoken openly, not only against Amazon and Mr. Bezos, but also with respect to Amazon's eligibility for this contract and whether it should get this contract, and that he would be asking the Pentagon to look specifically at the complaints registered against Amazon. Now, we could go on. There are a number of other comments. The complaint is framed around this, but because Amazon is well represented, the complaint doesn't simply rely on those for purposes of challenging the procurement. So maybe, Franklin and Alex, you can talk about if the complaint simply alleged these statements alone, which they considered to be improper bias, what do you think the chances are with respect to their likelihood of success?
This is Franklin. Thanks for the question, Dan. I would rate that at 0.000%. I think that it is, taking a step back, right, just purely based on what the complaint says, this is highly atypical. It's a highly atypical situation when you have all these statements coming out of the president. But that isn't what matters in terms of ultimately deciding whether or not the government did its job the right way here. What matters is whether or not the evaluation that was conducted was reasonable and consistent with the stated evaluation criteria, which is precisely why you have a very, very granular complaint here. And again, much of this information is redacted, but it's clear that Amazon's counsel went through the entirety of the then available source selection record and basically threw the kitchen sink. I mean, there are arguments that, you know, that the government essentially ignored the stated evaluation criteria, that they treated Amazon very unfairly by ignoring aspects of its own proposal, by favoring Microsoft when it shouldn't have, by doing just a variety of different things. You literally have a factor-by-factor assault here being lodged by Amazon's lawyers against the backdrop of, quite frankly, some unprecedented statements from the president, which, if you connect those dots, right, certainly from a public relations standpoint, militate in favor of, yeah, okay, well, you know, maybe something was done incorrectly. From a DOD standpoint, though, again, the only thing that matters is what does the evaluation record actually show, right? So when you get in there under the protective order and when Amazon's counsel looks at everything that the government did here, which is all going to come to light when the government files the administrative record of this procurement, which, by the way, it's essentially how the government responds to a protest, right? At the GAO, you see a response come through the agency report, which is essentially the government's reaction to the protest. You know, you'll see a legal memorandum, and you'll see the contracting officer's statement of facts, along with all sorts of exhibits that relate to the documents that were requested in the protest. You see functionally the same thing at the Court of Federal Claims. You'll see the administrative record come through, which is going to contain or should contain all of the relevant materials. Now, oftentimes parties will complain and say, no, you know, you need to provide more information. But when the administrative record in this case comes through, it's going to be incumbent upon Amazon's counsel to go through and to further connect the dots, right? And to show as a matter of law why what it said in the complaint is true and why the government's actions are essentially indefensible in the administrative record. Of course, the government for its part and Microsoft for its part will come through and argue the exact opposite, right? This is you'll see arguments that, you know, that Amazon is wrong as a matter of law, that irrespective of the bias or the purported bias, but I think it's, you know, I mean, all you have to do is read the president's statements here, that was not something that infected the source selection here, because the team itself performed its tasks consistent with what the actual evaluation criteria said it should do. So those are kind of the core arguments. And I'll pause here for a second, Dan, if you have any follow-up questions on that.
Yeah, one question I had. I mean, one of the themes of the complaint, if you could call it that, is that Amazon, consistent with some of the press accounts at the time, really was the only qualified entity to perform this service. And the government neglected to include past performance as one of the evaluation factors, which is a factor we typically see in many procurements. And I'm wondering whether that particular issue, in your view, both Alex and Franklin, carries any weight or will carry any weight as the court considers this protest.
Well, I'll start and I'll let Franklin chime in. I think there are a couple issues here. First of all, to the extent that it was missing and to the extent Amazon believed that it was something that was required in their proposal, and there's reasons, and we can talk about that in a sec, but to the extent that they believe something was wrong with the proposal, we didn't really get into it, but there is something called a pre-award protest. And a pre-award protest allows competitors, vendors and potential vendors to say, hey, listen, your proposal's not right because you're asking for this and you should be asking for that, or there's something wrong with it, or you're obviously only targeting one particular entity through this quote-unquote competitive proposal. So in that respect, there is an element to it where if there's a problem, and if there is a problem with the proposal, if there's a problem that's been identified, if there's something ambiguous, you have until the time that offers are provided. And to the extent that there's a problem, to the extent that somebody saw that the past performance was absent, I mean, everybody would recognize that past performance is generally something included in all competitive, most competitive procurements, someone would have raised their hand and said, hey, this is the problem. I think that in this particular instance, the reason that it sort of cuts both ways is really leading up to this procurement, only one company really had the muscles to flex to say, we do this kind of work, and it was Amazon, right? So that's why I think a lot of people believed initially that Amazon was the heir apparent to this contract. And I believe that there was a lot of negotiations and a lot of discussions about how best to address that rather large elephant in the room that, hey, really only one company has done this in the past to this size for the government, and it's Amazon. You know, obviously Microsoft and IBM, they have, you know, large enterprises, but no one on the government side. And when I see it in the complaint, I think, and you guys can tell me if I'm, you know, if I'm wrong, I don't think the lawyers are using it so much as to say the RFP was in error or was an issue. I think they're showing it more as a reference to the prejudice that the DoD was showing against Amazon by basically removing that advantage, removing that piece of the that flex, as the kids would say, that Amazon could throw down and say, hey, listen, we're gonna remove this. So now we're trying, in order to quote unquote, I think they talk about leveling the playing field, and Amazon believes that was improper.
I think that's generally right there, Alex. This is Franklin. I'll say, you know, the FAR specifically, the FAR, which we talked about earlier, right, the Federal Acquisition Regulation, you look at subparts 12206 and 15304, there's a fairly explicit requirement that you have to evaluate past performance as an important element of every evaluation and contract award that comes through for commercial item acquisition. This procurement is different. I think that the government's viewpoint on this would be that this is virgin territory, that yes, you know, it's clear, as you said earlier there, Dan, that Amazon was, you know, kind of the presumptive favorite here because it's, you know, got a lot of experience working with the cloud and assisting the government in connection with all sorts of cloud-based initiatives and projects, but not this. Not something like this, which is a really first of its kind implementation across the Department of Defense. I think Alex is exactly right. I think the reason that the government or the reason that it factors in the complaint is simply as, you know, additional thought or additional sort of evidence that should militate in favor of the fact in Amazon's view that the government, or I should say the argument in Amazon's view, that the government removed kind of an inherent advantage that Amazon would have. And that they did it sort of for at least in Amazon's view, a reason, I think, to come to a preordained conclusion that it was not going to pick Amazon in the first place, and it didn't want to have any criteria in that solicitation that could militate in favor of Amazon.
Right, and I would just, before we open it up to questions, would just hammer home the point that Alex already made, that Amazon really cannot argue that the solicitation was flawed because it didn't include past performance as an evaluation factor, because the law only allows them to launch such a protest before the offers are due. Once they submit the proposals, they are foreclosed from challenging what are called solicitation improprieties in the solicitation. But I think what the lawyers are doing here is they're saying that because of their past performance, because of who they are, their technical capabilities are so far greater than the technical capabilities within each of the evaluation criteria that do exist are so far greater than what Microsoft could offer that they were improperly rejected as the awardee in this case. So Wesley, I see we're 10 minutes out. We're happy to answer any questions that any of our listeners have at this point.
Very good. Thank you, Dan, and thank you, everyone. Dan, Alex, and Franklin, I'll let you know if anyone chimes in with a question. The queue is currently open. Alex, back to you.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, you know, one of the things that I think we probably should have started and led with is qualifying that what we know about this procurement is exactly probably what many people have seen. We obviously look at it through the constructs of our experience, et cetera, but in terms of reviewing the complaint, in terms of reviewing the press announcements by the DoD and by Microsoft and by Amazon. So, you know, by looking at this and by examining it, we're by no means trying to say, you know, one way or the other, who's right, who's wrong, or what have you. Just we're spectators of the game as well, and kind of enjoying the limelight that the government procurement process is kind of taking in this very, very large procurement.
Let me ask while we're waiting for a question, if we get a question, what are the possible remedies? What's the end result of this?
Yeah, I'll start. One of the things that's interesting about this, the particular selection of the Court of Federal Claims is the Court of Federal Claims general, as we look at it, the Court of Federal Claims generally has a propensity to kind of, I don't want to say side with the agency, but side with the deference given to the agency. That they tend to, because of their case law and the case law under which they operate, I believe that they kind of definitely lean in and respect an agency's wishes. I think this one's a little bit unique because of the, like Franklin said, the rather unique addition to that recipe of significant presidential statements to the contrary, and sometimes derogatory nature of the competitor. But in the end, when it comes to protest, this one's so big, this one's going to be challenging. What happens is you might win a protest. We haven't really talked about this. You can win a protest, and that doesn't necessarily mean you win the contract award. You know, yes, they might have done something right. Wrong. Yes, they might not have seen, you know, they might not have seen this, or they might not have taken something into consideration. But in the end, they'll say, thank you very much. We'll go back and look at it again. They can go back and look at it again after you've spent additional time and money and dollars and energy. And they can go, you know what, we're going to do it this way. And they could still award it to the same way in the same manner in which they did before. Alternatively, they could, you know, go back and try to figure out a way to change it to get to the same desired effect. It's not legal. It's not proper. But nonetheless, it's something that they can do. So just because you win a protest doesn't necessarily mean you also win the contract. So sometimes it could be, thank you very much for doing your civic duty. We appreciate you advising us of this discrepancy and this error. You still lose.
That's a really important point, that whether at the Court of Federal Claims or at GAO, rarely is the remedy, the end result, if the protest is sustained, an order by GAO, well, I guess it would be a recommendation, which the agency will follow, or an order by the Court of Federal Claims that you will award it to the awardee. Most often, it's go back and do it again, or go back and revisit a particular aspect of the procurement. And we also have a phenomenon that I think is occurring more and more, where a protest will be launched, but before the protest is actually decided, the agency will take it upon itself to engage in what's called corrective action. In other words, say, we're going to go back to the drawing board and reevaluate the price proposals or the technical proposals, or which is a win in my book, but it can, in the end, wind up with the same result.
I think, though, kind of the key distinction, so first of all, you're right? Anytime the government takes corrective action, they can go back and do a variety of different things, although I'll tell you, I've seen corrective actions being taken that result in the essential flipping of multi-billion dollar contracts, right? So it's not as though, you know, that they're all fruitless endeavors. But the one thing in terms of remedies, and you seized on it earlier there, Dan, was when you said that GAO can make a recommendation. That's absolutely right. The government can ignore that recommendation. It's seldom ever done because the GAO then has to kind of notify Congress as to what's happened here. And 99.9% of the time, the government will do what GAO tells it to do, which usually is go back and fix these issues, recompete it, and conduct an evaluation that's consistent with what the RFP says you need to do. The Court of Federal Claims have, I think, stronger teeth with respect to remedies. The law under which they operate essentially says that they can award basically any relief that the court considers to be proper. And if you ignore a federal judge's order, you can find yourself in contempt of court. There could be all sorts of negative things that would happen in that respect to the agency, right? So I think it's rare to see those types of orders come out of the Court of Federal Claims, but they are, in my view at least, stronger and sharper than the relief that you can sometimes get from GAO.
Yeah, and another thing, with regards to the corrective action side, one of the things that we've noticed too is we've seen the Court of Federal Claims be a lot more, this is where their deference kind of switches, a lot more, I should say, interested in corrective actions and probably more siding with the awardee, right, the person from whom the contract was taken. So that's another unique angle at the Court of Federal Claims.
We're almost done here, Wesley, and we obviously invite the listeners to the podcast once it's up and running to pose questions to us. You can find us at McCarter and English's website, McCarter.com. We'll also be following this case very closely. As I mentioned, it's been announced that Amazon does intend to file within the next few days. a request for injunctive relief, the government will drop the administrative record and its arguments in opposition to the complaint today, unless there's been an extension of that. So this is a big case that we'll be following, and we are at your disposal.
Thank you, Dan and Alex and Franklin. On behalf of the Federal Society, I'd like to thank you all for the benefit of your very valuable time and expertise today. We welcome all listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us for the call. We are now adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.